You're listening to the podcast version of Rational Alchemy. This is Brian Walsh, and this is Rational Alchemy. I'm joined tonight by Jeff Wagg at long last, who's been off doing something in the desert. I don't know. I wasn't there, so I don't have any information on that. Nigel Aves, as always, is with us, as is special guest Dr. Jennifer Newport, a pediatrician and organizer of Chicago Skeptics. How is everybody tonight?
Great.
I am good. I am well fed and hydrated.
So before we get started tonight, Jeff, I've been wondering, as I mentioned, you were out in the desert doing some kind of, you know, weird ceremony or something. You want to tell us about that?
Nope.
Fair enough.
No, I can. I just, I have a little bit of TAM fatigue. I just came back from TAM 8, where I spent 3 weeks in Vegas planning and carrying out the largest skeptics event in the history of mankind, so far as I know. And it was a success by any measure, and it was amazing, and I'm exhausted by it. And I don't know, what do you think, Jen?
I thought it was really fun. Someone was asking me about it at the Chicago Skeptics meeting, and they were trying to ask about best moments. And it seems like some of the best moments should have been like the Dawkins talk or, Phil Plait's talk was pretty darn good. But it wasn't... Whereas the big name speaker guy and women talks were great, really the best moments of TAM are just the hanging out with people and talking and being silly at the bar and seeing people you've met once or twice in your life and already you feel like you know them and making new friends. It's just such a very vibrant social community on top of all this great top quality skeptical, critical thinking, reasoning, organized talks. It was just delightful.
By the way, Phil's talk can be summed up with a few words, and those words are "Don't be a dick." That was the entirety of his talk, and that seemed to be the unofficial theme for TAM this year. Several of the speakers touched on that, and it really struck a chord with a lot of listeners. So basically what that means is just because you're a skeptic and just because you're probably right doesn't mean you should be rubbing it in people's faces or making fun of people who have different beliefs or whatever. Leave the door open. And his point was brought home by the fact that all of us at one point, or most of us at one point, were on the other side of the door at one time. So yeah, we could do a TAM wrap-up show, but let's not.
Right. Well, this isn't going to be one.
I also have just one question. Did the girls get arrested in the desert?
You mean the skeptic party?
Yes.
The Wild Wild West Bordello.
That's the one.
I didn't go. I was too tired. What I heard was that it was a lot of fun and very, very crowded. But I do not believe they got arrested.
I think they actually found a place far enough out in the hinterlands to avoid cop awareness.
So we have Dr. Jen Newport with us here tonight, and we are completely wasting her time.
Which is fine. I'm good with that.
All right, so enough about TAM and other sundry things. We do have a skeptical pediatrician with us, and that is actually really important. And I actually, my first question actually comes with a little bit of a story. I was at, and obviously I'm talking about a pharmacist now, not a doctor, but it was still very disappointing for me. I was at a Walgreens, and I noticed this big wall of homeopathic medicine out in the Walgreens. So I grabbed one of the packages and made a joke about it and expected to have a kindred spirit in the pharmacist. And instead, I was immediately chastised and told, oh no, I've tried that. It definitely works. And wow. Other times, I've spoken with my mother, who is a registered nurse, who believes in therapeutic touch. And I'm wondering, how widespread is belief in pseudoscience within the medical community?
It is widespread and growing. It's surprising how many major universities are incorporating a lot more quote-unquote integrative med, complementary med, also known to science-based medicine people as fake med options.
Not med.
Not med. If it were medicine, or if it worked, it would be called medicine. And you can find centers for integrative medicine at all the major universities, and most of what they do is fairly benign. Some stuff that may actually help people, or if it doesn't help, it at least makes them feel better a little bit. Stuff that is fully supported by the general medical community, like nutrition and exercise. These are good things. Meditation, there's nothing wrong with meditation. We're not saying it's going to cure your cancer, but it might make your day a little bit more pleasant, and you might be able to relax a little bit, and it might make your quality of life better. But the problem with that is that those centers don't stick with what's either proven or what's benign. They are very quickly linked to places that do some of the things that are more unproven, like herbal medicines that haven't been tested, or tons of homeopathy. You can very quickly go from, you know, such and such university's integrative medicine center to their wellness integrative medicine clinic to someone who's going to sell you naturopathic or homeopathic products. And I see this in general pediatrics, too. I mean, I see pediatric subspecialists who use things like acupuncture, which could potentially have some use in relaxation, or there are some interesting studies in pain control based on how your nerves gate pain. But overall, acupuncture fails at tests, and studied acupuncture fails over, like, just picking random spots on your body and sticking toothpicks on them, which is a lot cheaper and doesn't involve any blood. But they're using it not for those reasons, not for relaxation and such like that. They're using it for things that have been totally proven not to be effective. They're using ear acupuncture for asthma. And these are people who are subspecialty boarded, and they're offering this to their patients, and there's no science behind it, and they don't care. They believe in it despite evidence. Knowing it, despite evidence. They don't care. And just in the general population that I see day to day, not in the medical community, but in the patient population, a lot of the lack of knowledge, and I think that this is true of the medical community too, a lot of the acceptance of some of these alternative things really comes out of just not knowing what they are. I mean, I at least once every couple of weeks have a chance to ask a parent who has brought in homeopathic teething tablets or homeopathic cough drops. I have a chance to ask them, do you know what homeopathy is? And they all say, well, no, but it was at Walgreens and it said natural. Or no, but it was at Whole Foods and so I know it was okay. And then I go through the explanation of how homeopathic medicine is these infinitesimal, I can't even say that word, it's so tiny. The word isn't tiny. Teeny tiny amounts of molecules of ingredient mixed with gallons and gallons of water. And then they'll sell you, you know, an ounce of that water for $8.50. And it does nothing that water doesn't do.
I've noticed that most pharmacies I go to have a homeopathic thing. In fact, one test of this is pink eye. I think the only over-the-counter treatment for pink eye is homeopathic. Does that sound right to you?
Yeah, because
there isn't one.
We don't treat because it's a bacterial. Well, actually, most pink eye is viral.
Huh.
But daycares and schools won't let your kid back in unless you are on medicine.
Right.
And most pink eye is not that serious. It's not a big deal 90% of the time. But this is one thing that drives people to have to go to the doctor to get an antibiotic. And so a lot of kids are getting antibiotic eye drops, probably for something that they would cure themselves with time. Mm-hmm. We don't know which, you know, 10% wouldn't. But these parents go to the store knowing they're not going to let my kid back in school unless I've got some kind of eye drops for them. And so they pick up the homeopathic eye drops, and they may be highly convinced that they worked because they probably either cleared the bacterial infection themselves, or they had a virus that wouldn't have responded to antibiotics anyway.
Well, I always have a cloud of homeopathic air around me at all time, and every single wound I've ever had has been cured by this cloud of air. I mean, every cut I've ever had, I mean, they're all gone now. Look, do we see any cuts? I mean, yeah, I have a couple scars, but I have no cuts. And I have not treated these with any allopathic medicines at all. It's just been my homeopathic air cloud. So how can you tell me this doesn't work?
I can't, because you're right.
See? There you go.
Actually, one of the funnier times, well, funny and weird pediatrician funny, there have been a couple studies that show that honey, just plain old honey, is a more effective cough suppressant than any of the children's cough medicines. We simply don't recommend children's cough medicines anymore. I'm surprised that they still sell them, except someone will buy them, therefore they sell them, which makes sense. There was one that had whatever,
dextromethorphan,
50 million times diluted caffeine or something in it as the active ingredient.
But they won't call it that. They'll call it coffee cruda because that sounds,
And so that was their active ingredient. Their inactive ingredient was honey.
Right.
So they actually may have had some small amount of efficacy, but from their inactive ingredient, not from their active ingredient.
So they're taking the medicine by accident.
Yeah. Yeah. And not even medicine. I mean, I wouldn't call honey medicine. It's just, it soothes your throat somehow, and it's worth more study, and maybe it'll turn out that that's also not actually true, but it's a nice thing to be able to try something, but without any side effects.
That was awesome.
Really, the whiskey toddy, which of course is one of those famous recipes from centuries past, really does work.
Maybe, yeah. I mean, you get a little anesthetic action from the whiskey and a little soothing from the honey.
I make mine with lemon juice, so I'm sure that probably has some little thing in it as well.
Maybe some kind of astringent action on your throat. I don't know.
I mean, just because it doesn't come from your doctor and the pharmacist doesn't mean it doesn't have any action. But some homeopathy stuff, it's actually the inactive ingredients that are the thing. And, you know, with Zicam, the big thing with that was the zinc that was in there was not in homeopathic dosages, even though the box said it was a homeopathic remedy. So even though we often say that homeopathy is water or lactic acid or whatever the substrate is, there can be other inactive ingredients there that can actually be harmful. So, you know, I hear about people doing these overdoses of Calms Forte, which is a homeopathic sleep remedy. There actually can be some danger in that because I think these companies are so poorly regulated and so poorly, they don't control their product that well, that there could be something in there that could actually be dangerous.
Well, certainly we've seen herbal remedies that have been shown through independent testing to have high levels of lead or mercury or all sorts of just horrible contamination. Whenever it seems like you're getting anything that's over the counter that's coming from one of those off brands, especially one of the ones that is touting itself as being all natural and therefore better than, you know, real medicine, it almost seems like it's actually the exact opposite is the danger of being true.
One of the great things that the AltMed people have on their side is they don't have this need to be scientifically accurate. When I tell someone that you know, Medicine X probably will help them and likely won't have side effects, that doesn't sound as good as someone saying, this stuff is going to help you and it doesn't hurt you at all, unlike that other medicine. I can never be that absolutist because everything has side effects, everything has potential risks. Usually I'm picking something... Well, always I'm trying to pick something where the benefits outweigh the risks. But if you go to a lot of AltMed practitioners, since they're not science-based, and the science-based thing can be a hurdle because you can never be so darn absolutist. You can't say, I've proven this. Whereas someone who has some sort of dogma, whether that be medical dogma or non-medical dogma, some kind of spiritualism, whatever, they feel that they have the absolute truth and they don't require the scientific method to back that up.
Well, let's talk about that science-based medicine trend for a moment. And honestly, it kind of astonishes me that there needs to be such a thing as a science-based medicine movement. I just assumed that all medicine was science-based inherently, and I'm continuing to find that I'm wrong in that. So I want to think about the doctors themselves who are prescribing, say, homeopathic medicine or other types of alternatives that don't actually work, which you touched on before. Now, I can understand a parent seeing these kinds of things in a pharmacy and assuming they work because it's in a pharmacy. You expect that you're going to see medicine in a pharmacy. But for the doctors who are prescribing these things, and this might be speculation, but do you think these doctors really believe that these medicines work? Or are they just giving in to the parents who keep coming in and asking for it and give it to them as a knowing placebo, just hoping it'll get them to be quiet for a little while they do any real treatment?
I think most of the people who actually prescribe homeopathic medicines or naturopathic medicines, actually, I think that most of them believe in them. And I think that most of them haven't done the looking around to see that they're not true. It's interesting, in different countries, there's a very different culture towards herbal medicine and homeopathy, where as much as we're having to work against it here, if you went to France or Germany and told people that homeopathy didn't work, you would have a huge battle, because it's extremely long established, and it's so just part of the culture that people just won't believe you. And I think that there's getting to be enough of a populist push towards this alt-med that some people are kind of, they have heard a lot about it. They are looking for things to help their patients. They are frustrated that they can't fix things all the time. The people who I've seen use it, I think, genuinely believe in it. And admittedly, that is a very small sample, because most of the doctors that I know are science-based and don't use it. But of the small number of doctors that I personally know, I think they buy it. I think that they think it makes people feel better, which it probably does.
They're not being malicious.
They're not being malicious, and they're not abandoning Western medicine. They're not abandoning medicine.
Yeah, we have a problem with our words, actually. We're starting to adopt the words of the people on the wrong side of this issue by calling things Western medicine, as though there's an Eastern medicine that's a competing theory. There really isn't. If you go to China and you get hit by a truck, you're going to go to an ER, and you're going to get almost exactly the same care you'll get in the West, you know, because the doctors there realize that this is what helps people. So referring to something as Western medicine versus Eastern medicine is kind of, I don't know, it seems to me it's kind of a false dichotomy.
Well, that was one of the things I learned at TAM. I did not know that the word allopathic medicine was
made up,
coined by the homeopaths.
Yeah.
I didn't
Hahnemann,
know that.
Hahnemann made that word up to disparage medicine.
Yeah.
See, it's hard to even talk like this, but, you know, I think we have to spend some time and actually try to change the dialogue and use the proper words. There is no alternative medicine. There is only medicine. The stuff that's alternative medicine is stuff that doesn't work or hasn't been proven.
Right. It either works or it's a scam. And I've always liked the supplemental complementary in alternative medicine is
supplementary
the
medicine.
Yes.
This is a backup policy in case those antibiotics don't work.
Well, the scam acronym.
Yeah,
is all just,
right.
Yeah.
And scam. Yeah, that's true.
But, you know, I will come clean. There is a lot of placebo effect in what doctors do day to day. You know, with a lot of the medicines, and you have to treat, you know, a certain number of people to prevent one bad outcome, or you have to treat a certain number of people to have a provable effect. So for some people, they're getting a medicine that isn't directly helping them, but they think it is helping them, and their bodies are helping themselves. That medicine can help somebody, it just didn't happen to help them. But there's no way of screening out those people ahead of time. And that's hopefully, you know, as the science goes forward, we'll know more about that. But a lot of effects of things like anti-acid medicines and the speed with which people recover with antibiotics is fantastic. You know, I know that it's gonna reduce the length of their illness by 8 to 24 hours, and it's gonna reduce the rate of blah, blah, blah complication, but people are, you know, feeling better in a couple of hours. And that's a lot of placebo. I have no doubt that people can feel better and maybe even have more profound effects from placebo effect. A lot of people call Mylocon drops, which are the gas drops you give babies, parental placebos.
Is that dimethicone or
simethicone? Dimethicone. I don't know.
Really has an active ingredient.
It has an active ingredient, but that when you test it over large populations, doesn't seem to change the amount of fussiness in the babies. But the parents have had something to give to their baby that they think works, and just that feeling of agency, the feeling of having done something, likely makes the parents feel better. And maybe 20% of babies get a true effect out of it, but the majority don't. But more than 20% of parents think that it did something. Yeah.
I know when my my ex-wife was pregnant with their first child, it was a long labor, big baby, went 41 weeks or whatever. You know, it was getting to be like, okay, time for the baby to come out. She went to the OBGYN, and we also had a midwife, which is a separate topic we can talk about. But they were like, well, maybe you should try this. And they gave her some black cohosh. And there's no giggling on this show. And
Or spit takes.
It was none of them. But the OBGYN and the midwife were both agreed that this was so powerful that she needed to be very careful with it, or the baby could just shoot right out there in the waiting room.
And it was rocket this, baby.
This evil smelling black liquid that you had to put like two drops in a glass of water and drink. And guess what? She took it and she had the baby. It's a miracle. And you know, the whole time I'm thinking, I was not quite as into skepticism 14 years ago as I am now, but I was thinking, that seems kind of odd. I mean, really? And then, you know, so why are they giving her Pitocin to induce labor in the delivery room when they have this herb that does exactly the same thing? It just didn't make any sense to me. And now I think that it was indeed the placebo effect. She was in mental distress over the fact that she wasn't having this kid. And here was something that would make her feel better because she could believe that this would help what was going to happen no matter what. All pregnancies end.
and or they gave it to her, you know, 25 hours into it when it was about to end anyway.
Right.
You know.
Right. I mean, she had the kid a week later, I think. Actually, she, you know, what was interesting psychologically is they had an inducement date. She wanted to do a natural childbirth, but there was an inducement date. And she went, her water broke 6 hours before she was supposed to go to the hospital for her inducement date. Coincidence? Possibly. Maybe it was just like, it's okay, I can let go now. I mean, I'm not a woman. I don't know how these things work. But what, you think that's funny too?
I think it's funny because, yes, as if there's this like secret thing in women's brains that knows.
Okay, it's time.
Yes. I mean, for some women, probably.
Okay, so this brings up to me an ethical question. Which is, what are the ethics of placebo? If you're a doctor and you know that something is only going to make the patient feel better, and you know that it otherwise does absolutely nothing, is it still ethical to do that? I'm actually reminded of an episode of MASH where they were having a heat wave, and Hawkeye started passing out sugar pills, telling them they were anti-heat pills, and everybody felt better. But is that at all ethical?
Wow. It is a very undecided question. There still are people who give out pills that are called placebo. There are still people who give out sugar pills. Like with the Mylocon drops, when parents tell me that they're using them and they think that they're helping, what I usually say is, well, if they seem like they help, you can keep using them. If they don't seem like they help, stop. I don't do that with cough medicine because I think cough medicine has too many side effects. So if someone thinks the cough medicine is working, and I think, you know, the studies show that it's not working, I will say, well, it doesn't seem like that's actually useful. And because of the side effects, you know, jitteriness or drowsiness, depending on the kid, I would recommend stopping the cough medicine. But the idea of actually giving out a prescription for placebo is not commonly used, even though there might, you know, it might make people feel better. It's certainly not a decided issue.
Well, you could actually say, though, that here's this pill. It's very powerful, and it helps many people in your condition feel much better as soon as they take it. So, you know, I'm going to give you this pill, but understand how powerful this is. And then they take it, and they feel better. Now, you've given them a sugar pill. You have not lied to them, though.
I know. I
think it's a very difficult issue. I'm not taking a side on it. But there's a great, to pimp another radio show here, there's a great episode of Radiolab that talks about placebos. And it's actually frightening. And one of the things they point out is that many medicines we have today, and please correct me if I'm wrong, don't make you feel better. But they push a button inside you that makes your body release the chemicals that make you feel better. It's a fine distinction. They're like a stick being poked into a box that presses the button. But a placebo can also press the button. not through chemical action, but through, well, ultimately through chemical action, but through brain action. And I thought that was fascinating, but as skeptics, there's something, well, as a skeptic, I'll speak for myself, there's something in me that is terrified or horrified or disgusted at the idea of a doctor lying to you, even though it's in your best interest. It's a fascinating issue.
And right now, I actually want to take my initial question and that and extend it a little bit further. And I want to know if there's any danger to the public knowing too much about medicine. Now, my initial response to that is, of course, well, no. Everybody should be able to know as much as they can. But I can think of specific examples, and I'm kind of wondering here. Like, an example, I was at a bar recently, and I was talking to somebody who believed in homeopathic medicine. And the reason she believed in it was because she's suffered migraines her entire life. And she's been in and out of hospitals or in doctor's offices trying to get them cured, and they can't cure them, of course. And she didn't want to take heavy drugs to get rid of the pain, and she found homeopathic pills, which seemed to make her headaches go away. And I'm thinking to myself, now, if I or somebody else explains to her exactly why homeopathy is BS, am I going to be taking away the only thing that's making her life livable at the moment? Would that be bad of me to do?
Well, not if you can put forth an alternate suggestion, which is, you know what, homeopathy, you know, you can describe what homeopathy is, and you can say, but you didn't have the headaches. Your body was able to relax enough or refocus enough or whatever. Your body was able to overcome those headaches, those migraines, and you actually did it on your own. You know, that can be empowering too, although I do know that there are people who would just never accept that. One of my hopes with the placebo effect is that we just get better at figuring out how to, you know, harness it. Just like with natural herbal things, you know, a lot of those have real medical effects, and what we do is we find out what those medical effects are, and then we synthesize them and, you know, get the most specific chemical and make it reproducible. You know, if there is some way that we can trigger whatever chemical, you know, mental mind-body connection thing there is with the placebo effect, we can harness it to our advantage without fakery.
So this leads me to my question, which is a takeoff of your question, is, let's say there's an antibiotic. You have a resistant bacterial infection, and there's an antibiotic that's new to the market, and in clinical trials it's shown to cure this infection in 60% of cases. If you tell the patient that, is that going to lower your recovery rate? Because 60% is not a very powerful number. 60% is like, oh, damn, it might work. So can the placebo effect work in reverse, where if you cast doubt upon the treatment, it will lessen the outcome?
Probably. You just because phrasing of a question alters how people, I mean, people don't look at statistics like they should.
Right.
So 60% is still better than nothing. I mean,
yeah. 6 out of 10.
But
chances are this will cure you.
But someone who's going to and doesn't really want to take it, and it might, you know, again, I don't know what causes the placebo effect. I suspect, well, I don't want to make guesses at this point. But if you're not kind of harnessing all your body's abilities to use it, maybe. And we know, well, actually, the noisy placebo effect.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Where if you tell people that something's going to have side effects, they'll have them.
Mm-hmm. Especially if it's something like headache or queasiness or something that's often mental anyway.
Yeah. I also kind of wondered if there could be additive placebo effects. And I'm sure that someone studied this, but whether you get the placebo effect from the real medicine that you get, because part of your real medicine effect is the placebo effect. But if you add on to that some second layer of, you know, this other belief system type thing, you know, whether it's Oriental medicine or Native American medicine or something that sounds ancient and wise, is that additive? Can you have an additive placebo effect?
someone says ancient wisdom to me, and I think their lifespan was 40. I don't want to do anything that they did, but I'm not normal.
No. True.
Now, I did have one final question about the possibility of patients having too much information, and this is one that I think is the case of patients having too much, and that is pharmaceutical commercials on TV. A patient walking into a doctor's office and saying, I want Prozac because I saw, or I want Abilify or whatever because I saw it on TV last night and it sounds like what I need, instead of the doctor, you know, looking at the symptoms and providing what's appropriate.
Yeah.
Hopefully that leads the doctor to have to come up with rationalizations for why they picked the and real rationalizations, not rationalizations, but real rational reasons for the medicine that they picked. Because the doctors are hit by all those ads too, and they're hit by drug reps, and they're hit by prescription pads that have ads for drugs leafed in the middle of them. And, you know.
Well, and the free samples. I mean, you go to the samples. Doctor and say, I want Abilify, and the doctor opens his drawer and says, okay, here you go.
I got in the mail today.
Look, we have actual doctor mail here with us. Are we good?
I got in the mail.
Oh, Androgel.
How to apply Androgel.
Don't do that.
Blah, blah, blah. Anyway, this is something that I never, ever use, never would use. It has nothing to do with my practice.
It's not a great thing for pediatricians.
But I got a booklet of prescriber information. Basically, they were just cold calling me.
None of the stuff, though.
None of the stuff. It wasn't a sample, but it's an ad that came to my house.
I'm looking at this.
In a big envelope.
I'll show people on the screen. This is actually fairly intricate. I mean, it's a one white paper and then a more detailed white paper attached to it. This took a lot of effort and money to create.
And to send, apparently, willy-nilly to every doctor in the country or something. So I think that if patients come in with, I'd like this medicine, you should either say, okay, yeah, that is the best one, or you should say, well, no, I'm picking this one because A, it's generic and it has the same effect, but for, you know, 1/10 the cost. Or B, well, that would have been a good choice if you had symptom X, but because you've got Y and Z, that's not quite right for you. Some doctors take it as the easy way out, and they just say, oh, okay, that's probably fine.
Have you read this? This is.
I only read a little bit of it because, again, I don't prescribe it.
Signs and symptoms in children may include an enlarged penis or clitoris. This is weird.
Yeah. It's used for men who have testosterone.
Well, yeah, I actually know people who use it. But apparently, if you have sex with a guy who's using this, there's a very good chance that you will get a dosage of testosterone from this. And this is it's a list of instructions on how to avoid that. Wow. Completely cover the application area with clothing. That's not very fun. I guess he had think anyway. A little off topic here, but this was fascinating. I'll put this away now.
But you know, it's this big thing that comes in this big prescriber information envelope, and it leads me to open it because it's in my mailbox, and then it's nothing that I'm going to use. But if it were something that I used or something that was semi equivalent, then they would have just successfully advertised to me in my own home.
Yeah, and I'd like to add in here that while we defend Big Pharma a lot, quote unquote Big Pharma, I'd like to point out there's also a Big Herba and a Big Homeopatha. Homeopatha? That's a good word. I just made it up.
Big Homo.
They are the Big Homo. Yeah, no, we can't say that, especially not these days. There is a capitalistic side to pharmaceutical companies, and they are trying to make money, and they're not shy about this. And they will do things that will, hopefully for them, make them money that are not in the best interest of their patients from time to time. And I think that's unfortunate because the non-medical community can look to that and say, see, these are evil money-grubbing people. But it does happen, and we should acknowledge that. However, I would counter with all homeopaths and herbalists and naturopaths are greedy people who are unethical and so on and so forth. So, anyway.
Well, that's one of the problems, of course. You mentioned the shops that actually sell homeopathic medicine, and of course they're selling for $8 what actually costs about a quarter of a cent.
Oh, sure. So what's that? That the one that I can never pronounce? Oxylococcinum, oxymoronic.
Oh, yeah, whatever it is.
That's actually the one I brought up to the pharmacist at the list in the story from the beginning.
This stuff's been around forever, and if you look at it, theoretically, it is Muscovy duck liver is what's in it that cures the flu. However, if you took every pill of that was ever made, they would still have not needed to kill a single duck yet to get enough active ingredient for every pill they've ever manufactured. So, you know, the ducks are feeling good about this, but...
Yeah. Well, let's assume they did actually stuff a duck and actually took the liver out of one duck. Let's give them a little bit of...
All right. In like 1802 chance. Or something.
Yes. Yeah, it's amazing. Actually, I've got a question for Jen, sort of slightly moving away from this topic, but staying on topic. Have you bumped into any interesting anti-vaxxers in your career?
Yes. I get to do the Vaccines Are Good For You talk at least once a week. And I know a lot of pediatricians who simply won't do it, who will not have the talk about why vaccines are safe, why the scaremongers are not accurate, talk about the true risks of vaccines, because I know that there is a 1 in 25,000 chance of a seizure with such and such vaccine. It doesn't cause any neurologic damage, and it's going to be fine, but a parent who has that happen is going to be scared out of their pants. But there are tons of pediatricians out there who either take the tack, well, if you're not going to vaccinate, you can't come to my practice, or on the other hand, take the road of what some of the science-based medicine folk called shruggies. Just, who cares? If you want to stretch out your vaccines over the first 5 years instead of over the first 2 years, fine, whatever you want. Whereas I see the kids who get these illnesses early and know that protecting them early is important. It's important for building the immunity quickly. It's important for getting them protected as quickly as they can. And I will sit down with someone and talk to them about thimerosal. I mean, even though they've taken the thimerosal out of the vast majority of vaccines years ago, and even when the thimerosal was in the vaccines, they've shown that it does not have any impact. It's not related to autism. I still get that question regularly. What about the mercury in vaccines? To clarify, thimerosal as a breakdown product is mercury.
But it's ethyl, not methyl, and methyl's the harmful one, et cetera.
Okay. And exactly. And but people are still bringing up that old idea because they're still all buying, vaccine books that were printed 10 years ago. So I'm happy to go with them stepwise through it was shown that additive, which was actually put in to kill bacteria so that you weren't actually giving a bacterial illness while you were trying to prevent another illness. That preservative is no longer in the vaccines, and since they've taken it out of the vaccines, there has been no great drop in autism. And in fact, we've seen an ongoing increase. And by taking the time, and it takes time because these parents are scared. They're having someone else put a needle into their child, and that's viscerally scary. And they've got all this media saying it's dangerous, it's going to cause brain damage. And by just taking the time to explain the science of it and giving them some good resources, I've changed minds. People who were not going to vaccinate will do vaccinations. The same with some of my more extreme non-medicine user people, people who would practically go to Mexico to do chelation therapy.
Laetrile.
And, by discussing these things and discussing the true risks and lack of benefit, they've stayed involved in regular medicine. They may do their energy healing on the side, fine. That's their dime and their time. But they're staying with their medical treatments that are keeping their kids alive.
And on the vaccine thing, I'm sorry, go ahead, Nigel. You don't talk enough anyway.
With the... I mean, the anti-vax movement is still making, unfortunately, progress in their story. And there are now a couple of fairly large communities, in fact, that are totally anti-vax. When do you think that they're going to start getting real issues, especially with measles? It happened down in San Diego. But I remember there was a community up in Washington that was featured in the PBS documentary. I can't remember which one it was now. And that looked like a disaster waiting to happen.
It's one of those things that it will happen. We can't predict if it's going to happen this year. We can't predict if it's going to happen in 5 years. But there's going to be bad outcome. And in these small communities, there's been small bad outcome. But I suspect at some point there's going to be much more profound problems. I think about some of the schools where maybe a majority of the parents refuse to vaccinate. You get a couple of kids in there with the measles, and you have a small epidemic. I mean, we saw this happen with H1N1. Before we had a vaccine, it would spread through schools like wildfire, and everyone's like, oh, H1N1 was not the big deal that everyone thought it was going to be. Well, except for to those people who died from it, and those people who got meningitis from it, and those people who had ICU, prolonged ICU stays from it, it was extremely serious. So we're going to see that with whether it be measles, which has much more profound effects than people remember because it's out of our social memory for the most part. But, you know, brain inflammation and long-term neurodegeneration. And when there was a shortage, I don't think that we can blame this one incident on a highly unvaccinated community, but there was a shortage of a vaccine for a while. You combine the shortage of the vaccine, so there weren't as many people in general vaccinated for the Haemophilus influenza illness. And then you added into that a couple of people who weren't vaccinated. So you had an under-vaccinated plus non-vaccinated population in Minnesota, I think it was about 2005. And this illness that essentially throughout my residency and throughout my pediatric practice, I've never actually seen except the sequelae from people who had it years before. But this illness that I've never seen affected five kids with Haemophilus influenza meningitis in Minnesota, and it killed one of them. So the combination of the vaccine shortage plus non-immunizers, and one of the kids who was hospitalized couldn't be vaccinated because they had an immunodeficiency. And I believe, and I can't pull up the site right now, but I believe that the kid who died was actually, it was by choice, non-vaccinated by choice of the parents.
Oh, I was going to say the kid died by choice.
No, that's a whole different discussion. No, because the parents didn't get the vaccine. And I will say, with all of my extensive talking to parents, I will admit to using a technique of, you know, every other convincing person, which is at the end of all my scientific stuff, I throw in the, oh, and then of course there was my 3-week-old patient who was in the ICU with pertussis for 3 weeks because she caught it from somebody who wasn't immunized. And that is an absolutely true story. It's got an emotional punch, and the mom absolutely says that I'm allowed to say that, and I know that anecdote, as much as all my kind of science facty stuff, has just as much, if not more, impact on getting people, if not ready to vaccinate now, maybe ready to vaccinate at the next visit. And they stay and they get vaccinated. We have a very small non-vaccinated population in our office.
Well, I'm about to demonstrate my belief in vaccines by looking into a clinical trial for a vaccine for dengue fever. There is no vaccine for dengue fever right now, but they're testing one in Vermont. And when I go back, I'm going to see if I can get into the trial. And either I will be fine or I'll get dengue fever and die. But it's for you folks that I do this and not the $1,000 they're offering me.
And for the chat room, if he does die, we will need a co-host. Just
yeah.
So I do have kind of a capping question here. I do have kind of a like an overall question here, because to me, the prevalence of alternative medicine actually kind of makes sense. We have people who see this stuff in pharmacies, and there is a sense that doctors have been lying to us, or doctors are trying to make money, or they only want to golf, which has always been part of popular culture. So alternative medicine as a movement kind of makes sense as something that has happened and is growing in popularity, right or wrong. Same thing with anti-vaccination. In some ways, I can understand how the average person, it's going to make sense to them to say, well, why do I need to vaccinate against polio? I haven't seen polio in my entire life. Nobody here has polio. So obviously that's very wrong, but I understand it. So what I want to ask is, whose fault is this? Is it us, the skeptics, not verbalizing it enough? Is it the medical community that isn't expressing it in the right kind of way? Is it that the alt-medders are just shouting us out and drowning us out with people like Oprah and Jenny McCarthy? Is it a little bit of everything? I mean, what's really going on here? Why is the message not being received?
I have an answer for that that's a little unusual. I blame history teachers. This is a problem of humans not understanding history. We're not taught the amazing things that vaccines have done over the years. Oh, sure, we might learn about cholera in Wells in England and little things like that. But our classes of students are not taught in eighth grade. By the way, if this were the 1800s, about half of you would have died from diphtheria or typhus or some other disease by now. But thanks to the availability of vaccines, you didn't have to go through that, and your parents didn't have to have eight kids just so two would see adulthood. I really think it's an education problem, but I can't blame the doctors for that. They're not educators. I mean, education's part of their job, but that's not what they're there for. I really think it's part of the school system that has focused more on tolerance than on facts. In history, well, I'm sorry, I muddled myself with too many different trains of thought here, but suffice it to say that if we actually had a class on the history of epidemiology, I don't think we'd be having this problem with vaccines today.
I disagree.
Oh, but where's that mute button? It's on here somewhere.
No, I think just like, you know, you can say everyone should have a stats course and then people would understand a lot of stuff. You know, a lot of people don't. They won't. They won't get it. A history of epidemiology course will help the people who are destined to get it anyway.
Not even a course. Just a class. Just throw out those numbers. I mean, you're probably right. I think it is human nature more than anything. Because when the polio thing's a perfect argument. I've never known anyone with polio. Why do I need a vaccine for that?
Yeah.
That's a very logical thing to say. Well, I mean, you know, why do I need meteor insurance for my car? I've never heard of a car getting hit by a meteorite.
Do you have meteor insurance for your car?
Well, yeah, I do, actually. But I have seen cars get hit by meteorites, honestly. But anyway, I don't know. I want to blame somebody, and historians always seem like a good group to blame for just about anything.
I wonder if there's some kind of just a natural waxing and waning of interest in things, you know, like along with when you see these religious movements kind of, you know, swelling up at the ends of centuries and then backing off. There have been many waves of anti-vax movements, and there have been many waves of snake oil and quackery. I mean, I remember being in high school and learning about the snake oil type stuff and thinking, wow, that's so old-fashioned. We're never going to go back there.
Oxycocmoronal, yes.
Yeah, and then to realize, oh, wait, this is quackery. All this stuff is quackery. It's pure, simple, fake, not real anything except for a way for someone to make money. And so I see the historical thing too, but I wonder if there's a waxing and a waning.
I hope so.
Just... I don't know. Maybe
I think though there's another part of this that we're missing here is that whenever you see these people or hear these people, it is always about the individual making a decision not to vaccinate their kids without realizing or not wanting to realize that vaccinations have got absolutely nothing to do with the individual. It has everything to do with the herd. And I think the big problem is they say the herd. And, of course, everyone imagines a field full of cows.
Well, I think that the concept of civic duty died in the 80s. Doing something, you know, for your community or for your country, you know, nobody thinks like that anymore. I mean, except maybe some crazy Republicans. I mean, I think that concept is gone. So the idea that you should vaccinate your kids for the benefit of humanity never crosses parents' minds. Maybe I'm wrong, but that's the way it seems to me.
Well, and I also think that sometimes we go back to the herd immunity concept too much, because it is for an individual benefit also. It's definitely for the, you know, protection of that individual and the risks of that individual getting the illness, if that illness becomes prevalent again, outweigh, you know, the 1 second of pain.
Yeah, I've got a big old scar on my shoulder. I think, was that smallpox?
Yeah.
Did you have that?
Yeah. But my sister didn't, because she was born a year
right,
after me.
Right, because it was right at the cusp there, yeah. And
Jeff, before you go on, it's interesting. I'd like to ask Jen. Jen, have you heard about the vaccine patch that is now in test? It's an animal test.
The only thing I heard about it was just that Gates gave millions of dollars to help develop nanotechnology for a vaccine patch, but that is as far as I know.
Was it DHEA, that chemical that sucks things through your skin and carries anything with it?
The thing that I just said was all I knew.
Yeah, what they've done, these little patches, it's not like a standard patch. It has 100 micro needles, which are 0.65 millimeters in length. And actually what happens is the needles dissolve into the skin. So they dissolve on contact. So it actually is sort of like a painless vaccination.
But that wouldn't get the stuff into the muscles. So, well, I don't know how the stuff works.
But. Yeah. On tests so far, it actually does a better job than the conventional jab.
I'm thinking the tetanus, though. That needs to be intramuscular, right?
Well, maybe not, you know?
Yeah, I don't know. We need an epidemiologist and a vaccinologist.
I have this little pet theory that the fact that vaccines are mostly given by shots is part of the reason for the anti-vax movement. It seems very invasive to people, and people just at a gut level don't like shots. And though they would probably deny it to their end, that it's the actual jab that is what's bothering them, I think if the vaccines were all painless, I think you would see a lot of the concern, not all of it, certainly not all of it, but I think you'd have more people who were not as easily convinced. No one's tested this. This is my little pet theory from watching parents cringe and you know, feel awful that their babies have to get shots. They just feel awful. And if it were painless, they wouldn't feel awful, whereas they should feel good about it.
Well, there are reactions to vaccines.
There are.
And they're terrifying to parents, as I understand it. I mean, like
the possibility of having a reaction, which I have been just in general practice for 5 years, general pediatric practice for 5 years, residency for 3 years. So 8 years of full-time pediatrics, and I have yet to see a vaccine reaction worse than a skin rash.
So all these reports of seizures and...
You know, I probably haven't seen 25,000 patients yet. And, you know, 1 in 25,000 is a very small thing, especially when you're looking at a vaccine that could cause a fever. And a certain percentage of kids do have febrile seizures.
That's a seizure caused by a fever.
Yes. I use the fancy doctor word. As a not fond of needles person myself, I say bring on the patches, bring on the orals, bring on the nasal mists. You should see people change their mind when you tell them that they can get their flu shot by nasal mist instead of by shot. It's amazing.
Interesting.
Well, it does appear that we are running low on time. So before we sign off, I want to ask our guest, Dr. Jennifer Newport, are there any places where our listeners can go find more about you and your work?
You The only thing I want to mention is that the Chicago Skeptics, in conjunction with the Women Thinking Free Foundation and the Center for Inquiry Chicago, are really excited to host Dr. David Gorski from the Science-Based Medicine podcast, not podcast, Science-Based Medicine blog at the Chicago Skeptics Meetup August 21st. And if they want more information about that, they can either go to chicagoskeptics.com or the meetup site and then just search on Chicago Skeptics. And that should be great. We're going to have him do a talk in the afternoon of August 21st, and then hopefully we'll have a little cocktail party with him as the guest of honor that evening. So he's done a lot in terms of the pro-vaccine movement and just generally being an awesome advocate for pro-science-based medicine and taking the covers off of some of the hidden woo around the world.
All right, well, thanks. And that has been Rational Alchemy. See everybody next week.
Good night.
Bye.
Good night.
You've been listening to Rational Alchemy. For more information, feedback, or further discussion, visit our website at rational-alchemy.com. For questions or comments, email feedback@rational-alchemy.com. Rational Alchemy is produced at KRFC Studios in Fort Collins, Colorado.